Okay. Open up the House Committee on Education for May 13th, 2015. Welcome. Welcome. Today we're going to, it's kind of high technology day and getting some bills out on the floor. First thing we're going to do is we're going to actually open up with a work session on Senate Bill 79A. Richard, if you could explain what it is.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 79A requires school districts to provide instruction in CPR, cardiopulmonary resuscitation, and the use of automated external defibrillators, AEDs. It declares an emergency effective July 1, 2015.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Doherty, I move Senate Bill 79A to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Frederick moves Senate Bill 79A to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Maybe a lot of discussion when it was brought to us earlier. Okay, seeing none, could the clerk read the roll, please?
Representative
Barreto? Aye.
Representative Pack?
She's excused.
Representative McLean?
Aye.
Representative Peluso?
Aye.
Representative Reardon?
Aye.
Representative Wilson?
Excused.
Vice Chair Frederick?
Yes.
Vice Chair Springer?
Aye.
Chair Doherty?
Aye. Okay, with that, the motion passes. Do we have a carry? Do we have somebody that would like to carry this on the floor?
I'll do.
Okay, Representative Reardon will carry it on the floor. With that, we close the work session on Senate Bill 79A. And open up an informational hearing on open textbooks and all this high-tech stuff that we're looking at. So with that, I open up the informational hearing. And on the phone, I would like to introduce Dr. Cable Green with Creative Commons. So welcome, Dr. Green.
Thank you, Chair Doherty and members of the committee. My name is Cable Green. I'm the Director of Global Learning at Creative Commons. And I'll share in just a moment what Creative Commons is. I appreciate the opportunity to present and would encourage, as you've got questions along the way, feel free to interrupt me anytime.
Thank you.
So first, this entire slide deck is openly licensed. If you don't know what open licenses are, you certainly will by the end of this presentation. And part of what we do in the open educational resources world with open textbooks and open curriculum, both in K-12 and higher ed, is we always give proper attribution and credit to those that we've borrowed from. And so this slide deck is actually a remix from several other leaders around the country who work in this space as well. So I want to give them proper credit. To tee off this conversation before we get into open educational resources and open textbooks in particular and how Oregon might use that in your education system, it's important to understand how the world has changed around us in terms of technology and how that enables sharing of educational resources in a way that really never has been possible before in human history. So the first, we like to say that knowledge is magical. So Jefferson talked about this. I can light your candle without losing my light. I can give knowledge without it being given away. But physical expressions are not. If I've got a paper book, I must actually give you that book, and when I give it to you, I no longer have a copy of it. And this causes us, obviously, challenges in the education space because we buy textbooks and other resources in paper format, in physical format, and then we have to use them for sometimes up to 7 to 10 years before we refresh those. And when one student has access, by definition, somebody else does not. But of course, when expressions are digital, they also take on this magical quality where I can share with everybody at the same time without doing harm. And this is really an indescribable advance in first time in human history where both knowledge and expressions can be shared or given without given away. And of course, we recognize this, say, with a newspaper as an example we're all familiar with. It used to be that if I showed up at, a Cher Dougherty's home and I took the Oregonian newspaper off her doorstep, she would no longer have a newspaper. But today, many of us simply look at the Oregonian website, and millions of us can do so at the same time without doing harm to anyone else. This gives us unprecedented capacity, obviously, in education because we can share as never before, and because education is fundamentally about sharing knowledge and information and ideas, we can educate as we've never before. And of course, sharing in an online space means the ability to copy and distribute. Education sharing means copy distributing, but also the ability to adapt or edit. So for example, I live in Olympia, Washington, just to your north. My state has been very active in K-12 OER, and while you're certainly welcome to make copies of all of those resources at no cost because we've openly licensed them, Oregon districts would very much like to adapt those resources or edit them. So, for example, your average 250-page textbook that you use in Oregon schools has a particular cost associated with it. The costs under the current model are quite high. They're usually north of $100 per book when you're purchasing paper copies. Of course, when things go digital, we get into these types of interesting conversations. And I want you to look at the last bullet point there, where we can now make copies of digital things for not quite zero cost, but very close to zero. So that you can see that 0.00084 number. That's how much it costs to make a copy of a digital textbook once it's built. And of course, the cost of distribution have also fallen to those very, very low numbers. Take a look at that last bullet point. Now, I want to emphasize here before we proceed that the costs, total costs, have certainly not fallen to zero. If the cost of production of a digital textbook are very high, the cost of maintenance of that educational resource also high. But because we can spend money once or to build, say, exactly what Oregon wants for sixth grade algebra, Oregon could expend those monies once and pay for maintenance annually of a particular resource. But once it's built, it literally costs near zero to share it with everybody else on the planet. So that's what's different about today than 15, 20 years ago or before. So in education, we're starting to ask questions and have been for a decade. We're asking questions like this. When copying, distributing, and storage have essentially become free, what do we as educators and as legislators and other public servants who care about education, what do we do with those capabilities? And except we can't. And of course, there's copyright law, and there's copyright law in every country on the planet, including the United States. Copyright law is a good thing. It protects authors' rights to make sure that they are able to commercialize their works, to make copies of their works, perform them, distribute, etc. But all of these wonderful things that we can do with digital things, copyright law, for the most part, forbids unless we have explicit permission. So another way to think about it is that copyright cancels most of the possibilities or innovations that can happen with digital media and the internet before we're able to do that. And so as you're having conversations about internet and devices for kids and high-speed bandwidth to schools, one of the things that we have to remember is that copyright forbids many of these activities of copying and distributing and making changes or making derivative works. And so this is where my organization comes in. I work at Creative Commons. I lead our education efforts and much of our policy work. And we're a nonprofit organization. We're coming up on 12 years old. And we build the free open copyright licenses that the world uses to share not only education resources, but also scientific resources, peer-reviewed journals, music, movies, anything that can be copyrighted can be shared under an open license. We operate worldwide. We've got teams in 83 countries around the world, including the U.S. And what's important about Creative Commons is to understand kind of where it fits in this continuum of intellectual property rights. So we're all familiar with copyright on the far right here. And copyright is essentially if I create something, you don't get to use it without my express permission. And on the other end of the spectrum is public domain. In the United States today, after the author dies, and 70 years go past after the author's death, then the work goes into the public domain. The question that educators around the world started to ask a decade ago is, what if I want to keep my copyright? What if I'm a professor at Oregon State University, or I'm a teacher at one of the schools in Salem, Oregon, and I've produced something that I hold the copyright to, but I also want to share it with all the other K-12 schools in Oregon? Or what if I'm the Oregon State Legislature and I want to have commissioned a sixth grade algebra book, and I want the state to hold the copyright on that, but I also want to share it permissively with all the other schools in the state? How do I do that? And the answer was it wasn't easy to do, but Creative Commons came along and said, look, we're going to make that easy to do, free to do, and legal. And so Creative Commons licenses are simply this. People, individual authors, the holders of the copyright, the people who own the intellectual property of an open textbook or a video or whatever we might use in our schools, get to decide which of these conditions they want to share with everybody else. So attribution is I want to get credit for my work. Share alike says if you change my work, you have to share your new version forward with everybody else. So you may be familiar with Wikipedia. Everything in Wikipedia is under an attribution share-alike license. Non-commercial means you can take my work, but you can't sell it. And no derivatives means you can take my work and use it for free, but you may not change it. And so when you mix these different conditions together, what you get are one of these six different Creative Commons open copyright licenses. I should pause and say that these are all free. There's no cost to this. We don't charge for it. Our mission in the world is to make sharing legal and easy and free to do when authors choose to share. So this is not about forcing anybody to share who doesn't want to. It's simply enabling those who do want to share to make it legal and simple. So when we're thinking about education, and at OER, you're probably familiar with the phrase open educational resources. We'll talk about that in a moment. Some of our licenses work well and some of them do not. So when we say on the left here, most free to least free, what we're talking about is how many degrees of freedom or how much flexibility are we giving to other educators around Oregon and around the United States and, in fact, around the world to use and leverage the works that we're producing? And the closer you are to the top of this licensing regime here, the more flexibility you're giving to others. And as you see at the top there, it says public domain. We actually have a tool called CC0 where if someone wants to dedicate their work to public domain today, they can do so. Most authors do not. Most authors want to keep their copyright and choose one of the Creative Commons licenses. So next question people usually have is anybody using it? Well, yeah, there's been quite a bit of growth. We're actually north of 1 billion licensed works on the web right now. And that's a mix of, again, education, science, culture, libraries, museums use Creative Commons licenses, et cetera. And then here's just a quick snapshot of kind of who in the world is licensing works under Creative Commons licenses. This gives you a flavor. The United States has been up front. Europe's catching up fast, but I can tell you the biggest growth area right now is actually in Africa. That percentage will rise rapidly in the year 2015. I mentioned Wikipedia, but there are several big platforms and user sites out there that default to Creative Commons licensing. Wikipedia, everything is under an attribution share-alike license. Many of you have probably seen Flickr and other photo sharing sites. Flickr and many others enable authors to add an open license to their works when they update them. This is a picture of the Super Collider, the Hadron Super Collider at CERN. This is where they figure out how the universe works. These folks actually release their images and many of their videos in near real time out to the public because their mission is to figure out how the universe works. And they know that there are some really smart physicists and chemists in the state of Oregon and cosmologists who they'd like to interact with, but the only way to get the expertise from Eugene engaged in this conversation is actually to get that information and knowledge not only out onto the web, but out onto the web under a permissive Creative Commons license so that Oregon State University and University of Oregon can use it and contribute to the conversation. So we're talking about education. I won't dwell on higher ed, but higher ed's been at this for almost 15 years now, even before Creative Commons licenses existed. There's something called the Open Education Consortium, where there are quite literally hundreds of universities around the world that have just opened up their curriculum, put Creative Commons licenses on some or all of it. One example you may be familiar with is an institution called MIT in the United States. Everything at MIT has a Creative Commons license on it, and you can download their entire curriculum today if you'd like to use it. Another good example just south of you is at UC Irvine. Their entire chemistry department just went open. And the idea in higher education is that we have a mission in higher ed to help educate the public. And in fact, that's a similar mission in K-12. Right, we want an educated citizenry. We want people to do well when they are out looking for jobs, and we believe that education makes people better citizens. And so to the extent that we can reduce the cost of education, increase access, these are the primary goals of open education. This is just a quick look at what's happening in the United States. Utah has been a real leader. in this, but many other states are catching up. Washington also an early leader, and thrilled to see Oregon having this conversation as well. So I've thrown around this term open educational resources, and we've talked about open textbooks, but we haven't really defined what that means. So let me just take a moment and do that. This is a definition that most people around the world use. It's from the Hewlett Foundation. There are derivations of this at UNESCO and the Commonwealth of Learning and OECD and other organizations. But the gist of it is kind of everything you use in education either has to be in the public domain or under an open license that permits free use and repurposing by others. So a simpler way to think about it is the content, if it's going to be an open educational resource, or including an open textbook, it must be free, meaning I'm not being charged to access it, and I must have the legal rights to do what we call the five R's. So I have to be, so let's take a take an open textbook, for example, from CK-12 that Oregon's high schools might want to use. Can you reuse it at no cost? Yes, you can. You don't have to ask permission. Can you revise it, modify it? Yes, you can. Whoops, I need to go back one slide. Can I remix it? Could an Oregon high school take it and throw away half of it that it didn't like and rewrite the other half? Yes, under a CC license, you're allowed to do that. Can I redistribute it? If the legislature provided some grant funding to Oregon districts to build out some open educational resources so that all Oregon students had not seven-year-old out-of-date math textbooks, but they were all up-to-date every year, could they be built at one district and shared across the entire state? If it's under an open license, yes. And then this one's really important, this idea of retaining. It may sound obvious, but it's not. So one of the new models that we're seeing from commercial publishers is they also are moving toward digital for all of the obvious reasons. Their storage, distribution, and replication costs have also fallen to near zero. But this idea of retention is not part of their model. So the new model that we're seeing from publishers, both in K-12 and in higher education, is that the school districts in Oregon and other states will pay an annual licensing fee to access the digital resources, which is fine. The challenge is that if you stop paying that licensing fee, you lose access to all of the content, so you don't get to retain it. And many would argue that because we can share at the marginal cost of zero, that especially in education, maybe we should do that. So again, what the internet technology enables, where it copyright forbidden before, OER permits it. We're actually able to make copies. We're able to share at the marginal cost of zero. What are some of the benefits of that? Well, in Oregon, I expect like Washington, you have students in your schools where English is not their first language. So translations can be made without asking for permission. You can translate curriculum into Spanish, my guess is be your second language in K-12. Accessibility. We're all subject to 508 federal guidelines saying that anybody that walks into our educational settings in public education must be able to be a full participant, including if they're not able to see or hear or have other physical disabilities. OER enables organizations to come in and actually fix and make it accessible. These are probably the most important for your teachers for your districts. The first one is customization. So I often say to both teachers and faculty in higher ed, if you're working with content today that you, the Oregon School District, do not have the legal rights to modify to make it exactly what you need it to be, then frankly, you're working with the wrong content. And legally, if you try to change something that's all rights reserved content, you're violating U.S. copyright law and your school district could be sued. And that's not a situation you want to be in. You want to have the legal rights to modify it to meet your needs. And then affordability, obviously, is key. In my state, in Washington, it's common for our resources in any of our 294 school districts to be, on average, somewhere between 7 and 10 years out of date. In fact, I was talking with a district just next to my house the other day, and I said, how many of your textbooks in grades K through 12 across 8 subject areas did you update for 2015? And their answer was zero. We made no updates this year because we had budget constraints and we had to spend money elsewhere. So none of their resources are being updated. And that's a major problem. I mean, I was sitting down with the Seattle superintendent a few months ago, and I said, do you have any textbooks that are out of date? And they showed me their political science textbooks for grade 10 and the copyright date was 1998. And so ask yourself, you know, has anything changed in political science since 1998? I think it has. Now to open textbooks, which is part of open educational resources. OER includes not just open textbooks, but also the curriculum, videos, simulations, games and learning, anything else you might use in education. Here's an example from higher education, but also high schools across the country are using these books. This is a project out of Rice University in Texas. It's called OpenStax College. All of these books, and you will notice that these are all highest enrolled courses. These are also all courses that are taught in your high schools, especially in your AP courses in high school. These are all under a Creative Commons attribution license, which means that they are all free to Oregon. You don't have to ask permission to use them. You can modify them to meet your needs. And the only legal requirement on Oregon high schools or colleges would be to give attribution to OpenStax. That's all you have to do, is say, I got this from OpenStax. I acknowledge where it came from. That's it. In K-12, there's a major project in the United States called CK-12. These are also all free. They are under Creative Commons licenses. You may modify them to meet your needs. These are under an attribution non-commercial license, which means the only thing that Oregon cannot do with them is sell them. So you can't put them up on the web and charge $50 for them. That would be violating the license. But given that's probably not your main intent, the message to your districts could be, you might want to take a look at CK-12. And in fact, this is a screenshot where I plugged in Oregon curricular standards. They have aligned their books and in fact modified their books to specifically meet not only Oregon state curricular standards, but also the Common Core standards. And of course, Oregon is in its math and ELA is a Common Core state. And so, you know, this is sort of the big question. In the United States, these are US-wide numbers. We've got thousands of districts across the United States, and collectively we spend $8 billion a year on textbooks for K-12, and these are the results that we're buying today. And so, and I'll let you read those, but ask yourself, are you okay being the public stewards of the funds for one of those 50 states? That these are the results we're getting. In many states, people are saying, no, I'm not okay with books being a decade old. My kids deserve better than that. Paper only? No, thank you. We have computers at our house. Some of us have tablets. We would like our children to be able to access digital versions. Kids can't write or highlight in their books or customize them to do, you know, like they can with anything else they own. That's not helpful. Students can't keep the books at the end of the year, so when students leave Oregon schools, your teachers, and this is at no fault of your schools, it's just the model, but you say, thank you for finishing grade 7, give all your educational resources back, good luck in grade 8. With open educational resources, you can say to your grade 7 students, keep all of your educational resources. You own those paper copies, you own those digital copies, you have the legal rights to keep them forever. We hope that they might be useful as you finish out high school. Of course, we'd like to move from your teachers and your districts having all rights reserved content that they can't update to giving your districts and their curriculum directors and the superintendents and the teachers the legal rights to modify the works to meet local needs. And I don't know about Oregon, but in my state, if the kids lose the books, oftentimes districts make the parents pay for those books. And it's a regular occurrence, especially in our low-income families, where we have parents telling their students, we don't want you to take your books from home to school and back because you lose things, and we can't afford to replace the book. And so this is the model that we spend $8 billion a year on. Just to wrap up, and then I'm going to stop and take questions, many states, including Oregon, have said enough is enough. This model is not something that we choose to be our future. And instead, we're choosing OER. And so the states, 12 states to be specific, have launched something called the K-12 OER Collaborative. You'll see the web address there. And I would encourage you to look at it if you're interested. And the collaborative is a group of states, including Oregon, which are saying, we can do better. We can find significant amounts of money, both from private foundations, and then eventually, potentially part of what we spend on textbooks in our school districts, part of our existing budgets. But if we pool our resources, we can spend what needs to be spent to develop exactly the high-quality, effective resources, including textbooks that we need. We will design them. We, the states, will own them. We will hold the copyright to what's built. We will put out competitive RFPs so that the publishers and, frankly, the math department at the University in Oregon or anybody else who might want to build the educational resources that we need will pay them very well, not only for the production, but also an ongoing maintenance contract so that we have not 10-year-old content, but our content is updated annually. And because we are the copyright holders, we will put a Creative Commons attribution license on everything that we build so that every school in the state of Oregon, every school in Washington, in Idaho, in Oregon, in Wisconsin, these are all states in the collaborative, have the legal rights to not only use it for free, but to modify it to meet their local needs. We, the states, will continue to drive what updates are made to this curriculum, and we'll have conversations. In fact, the states make up the governing board of this group. And just to give you a sense, and then I'm going to stop, of where this project is right now, it has actually put out open competitive RFPs, open to all for-profit and not-for-profit institutions which would like to respond. And we are now making 10 contracts to vendors, all of which are for-profit companies in the United States, entrepreneurs in many cases, who are building what we call rapid prototypes. The states will then evaluate which content they like and which they don't. And then larger contracts will go to a fewer number of vendors to build out all of the K-12 math curriculum and all of the ELA curriculum. These states all happen to be Common Core state standard states, and they have an immediate need in those two subject areas. And so they have decided to start there. But the broader goal of the K-12 Collaborative is actually to push OER or have OER designed by the states in all subjects, all grades. Of course, a very important point of all of this is that this is nobody's mandated to do anything. And of course, most states do not have the authority to mandate content to the districts. It's a local control decision. But this project is about building the content that the states want and then making it known to all of the districts in your state and, frankly, every other state. Here's this content. If you would like to use it, you're welcome to do so. If you want to change it, that's fine. It's under an open license. Let me stop there.
Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Cable. Any questions from the panel? This is Representative Reardon.
Good afternoon. It's good to hear you again. I heard your presentation earlier this year, so it's even better the second time. But what I don't remember, and this is killing me as a former business guy, is how was money made on this?
Yeah, so for open educational resources, the way that money is made on this, so I'll speak about the K-12 Collaborative as an example. We anticipate that in order to build out all of the two subjects, math and English language arts for K-12, it's probably around a $30 million project. So this is not free, this is very expensive. We anticipate that it's probably a 20 to 25% maintenance fee on that $30 million annually, maybe a little bit less. But let's just call it $30 million. So what's happening right now is, in fact, foundations that fund education in the United States, so Gates and Hewlett and Lumina and everybody else, are looking at the textbook market in K-12 public education in the United States. And they're thinking about that slide that I had up a minute, that we spend $8 billion a year and we get really lousy results for that investment. And the foundations are saying, that's nuts. What can we do to help? $30 million to them is not a lot of money. And so we're finding ways to raise that $30 million, and we've got a good start. We've already got $2 million in the bank, and we're closing in on more of that in committed funds. And then we're looking to make a major push to get it up to the 30. We're also having interesting conversations. We had an interesting conversation with 10 school districts in the state of California, and they shared that they are going, just these 10 districts are going to spend $250 million just on math in the next year. So the money is there and is being spent. We're just getting really bad results for it. And so what we're doing, so to answer your question, how do people make money? We're going to put $30 million out in an open competitive RFP and say to the businesses who are the publishers of the United States, we want to give you $30 million. Would anybody please take this $30 million and build for the states exactly what they want? Publishers, what's different is that the states are going to hold the copyright. You no longer have exclusive copyright to these materials. Now, we will give you non-exclusive copyright, and we're going to openly license these resources under a Creative Commons Attribution License. So you can, if you're the publisher, you can take these, you can go try to sell them if you want. They're going to be free over here with us, so probably nobody will buy them. But publishers, you may want to build additional resources around this. So what we don't pay for, you know, maybe we don't pay for slide decks or assessment test banks or example teacher editions. I mean, there's all sorts of auxiliary resources. And we'd like to pay you, the publishers, to, we'd like to give you a maintenance contract to keep this up to date. So the idea is, the big idea, is that today the market is roughly $8 billion a year, and we're all getting really lousy results for that investment. A right sizing of that market is probably closer to $2 to $3 billion a year, but the states would hold copyright, have up-to-date resources, digital and paper. Nobody would ever lose access. It's simply a shifting of the model to acknowledge that we have technical and legal tools today that we didn't have a decade ago.
Okay, thank you very much. Other questions? Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, in that model, I would think the more states that you get on board, the better the bidding process for the books would be. But once that's established and you decide on one publisher or maybe a couple in different categories, what's the incentive for other writers to try and get in on that if the purchasing's already been established and the state owns that book, and then also the opportunities to improve on that product as the years go on?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So from the state's perspective, what they want is obviously they want the best content, they want best practices, they want to see continued improvement and iteration, both in terms of technological advances, so things like customized learning pathways for individual learners to be able to move faster or slower depending on where they are in the course. And those are all innovations right now that people are, that many entrepreneurs out in the field are experimenting with, and it's yet to be determined what best practices look like. So I think there's lots of opportunities in the technology space where we would continue to reach out to the free market and say, what have you got? And show us the best. I think it's fair to say, I can't speak for the states, but as I listen to them speak about this, they're certainly not looking to lock in vendors indefinitely. However, they do own the content in perpetuity. So when the states put out the $30 million and purchase from a particular set of vendors what they've purchased, they are not bound to those vendors in the future. Another vendor or another author might come along 2 years from now and say, I can do better. And the states would say, you know, show us, and maybe we'll shift you to be the new maintenance contract or to rebuild it completely. What's so exciting about this model in terms of a shift in procurement practices, really is what it is that the public has ownership of what it's paying for and gets a better product for a significantly less amount of money.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Okay, Dr. Keeble, we don't have any other questions, or Dr. Green, no other questions, but I appreciate you presenting this information. I'm especially intrigued with the revision part of it because I was many decades ago a high school history teacher, and the textbook that we had was, you know, published for a national audience, and there was nothing in World War II on the West Coast textbooks about the internment of the Japanese because that was a West Coast issue. And so it would be nice to be able to team up with the Oregon Historical Society and be able to have something like that in the textbooks. And I even wonder now whether they actually have things like that in the textbook, because it was an Oregon, Washington, California, Hawaii issue. So it was very good.
And that's a perfect example of where Oregon might say, is there an educational resource that's unique to our schools that we might want to invest in at a state level? Pay somebody well to do it, maintain it, but then make it freely available at our schools so it's always updated. One last point, Madam Chair, if I could make it. As was mentioned, I was at the Higher Education Policy Committee in Oregon a few months ago, and when I was there, that committee mentioned that it wanted to put forth a bill that was about open educational resources. Since then, they have. It's House Bill 2871. And if your committee hasn't looked at it, you might want to. It appropriates about $1.1 million to your Higher Education Coordinating Commission to give out grants around open educational resources to Oregon public universities and community colleges to examine OER, review it, build new OER, to prominently designate it in course materials. It's a very interesting incentive program from the state. We have something very similar in Washington, where our state legislature first provided money to the community colleges. The outcome of that was the entire general education curriculum moving to OER. It's called the Open Course Library. And then that was so successful and saved students tens of millions of dollars in textbook costs that the Washington legislature then invested in K-12 and now provides ongoing funds so that there are two staff in the Department of Education in Washington that focus 100% of their time on open educational resources and working with the K-12 schools.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate your joining us today. And actually, I will think of you and wave at you on Saturday on my way up to the Mariners game on Amtrak. So when we're stopping in Olympia, I'll think about you.
Thank you. I will wave back.
Thank you very much. Okay. Okay, the next two people, we have two people from ODE to talk about the open textbooks, Carla Wade and Sarah Haven. Thank you very much.
Hello, Chairman Daugherty and committee. For the record, I am Carla Wade from the Oregon Department of Education, where I'm the digital learning ed tech specialist, and I also work with district and school improvement planning. Additionally, I am the chair-elect for the State Educational Technology Directors Association, which is a collaborating organization with the work that Dr. Green was just speaking about. And I'm sharing some resources with you that I'll talk about later this afternoon.
And greetings as well. My name is Sarah Hovind. I'm a program analyst at the Oregon Department of Education, and I have been working closely with Kim Patterson and Mark Fried and others at the department on this collaborative K-12 endeavor that Cable was talking about.
Thank you. Okay. Who's going to go first?
Well, I would just say that, I mean, Cable spoke so well on it, and I know that we're short on time, so I would just add that from an Oregon perspective, the vetting of the vendors that we did for the rapid prototype was a very rigorous process, and all of us were involved, Mark and Kim and myself and others, ed specialists at the department were involved, and we're very excited about actually it's quite a few vendors who are participating in smaller chunks of the math and the ELA curriculum. And as Cable mentioned, it will continue to be a competitive process. But this rapid prototyping will be a very, it will clarify what exactly it is that we might get. And then we can go from there. We'll be developing over the next year another rigorous process for the 12 states, all of us included, involved in that, vetting what's produced and where to go forward, how to go forward best.
Okay, thank you.
One of the things that's happening in a lot of our schools across the state is the deployment of mobile learning devices, whether it's tablets or laptops or even your phones. We have learning resources available to our students like we've never seen in history. What this allows for our students is anytime, anywhere, both online and offline access to materials that allow a teacher to personalize learning for a student. So it takes into account my interests that I can delve deeper into and do more research on, but it also allows me to, as a teacher, to provide specific resources that are at my rate and level for learning. For example, in a classroom I visited just last week, the students had available a resource that was on current events. So every student in the class was reading the same article, but Sarah's was lexiled for her reading level, and I was lexiled at a lower level because my reading, I have some difficulties reading, and the TAG students had it at the highest level that was available to meet their needs. What this means is that all students in the class can now carry on a conversation about the same current event, and the abilities of the students disappears or becomes invisible to the class as a whole. And this is critical as we're moving forward and meeting the needs of our individual students. We have available to students now in Oregon high-definition graphics and videos and simulations that can be used in classrooms. So if I want to do a science experiment at an elementary level, but I don't want to bring in the chemicals or I don't have the equipment, I can now do this virtually through options that we have available to our schools. The other thing that I shared with you earlier was the document Out of Print, Reimagining Textbooks in a Digital Age. This comes from the State EdTech Directors Association, which is the principal association serving and supporting and representing state and territorial education technology leadership. What's great about this organization is that we work together across corporate partners as well as educators from both higher ed and across the states to develop resources that I then use and my colleagues use for professional development to our educators across the state. In addition to Out of Print, specifically just on open education resources, we've developed resources on the accessibility of learning content for all students, especially students with disabilities. Another report on clarifying ownership of teacher-created content, empowering teachers to personalize education and address individual student needs, and rubrics for evaluating open education resources. It's based on the Achieve resources rubrics that are used nationally. But what's really important about this is we have teachers pulling a lot of open education content off the web and using it in their instruction. It's important that they understand and learn how to vet this content so that they're discerning users of quality content, providing quality learning opportunities for our students. The resources from CETA help us develop professional development that we use across the state. As we see increased access of technology for learning, access to open education resources is an essential component of learning in the digital age. And if you have any, go ahead.
I just want to build on what Carla just said a little bit, and that is that, yes, teachers are using open education resources already, especially in those classrooms with the digital devices, and with their textbook from 1998, they are using what they can from the internet. The difference is that with this collaborative, we will be able to provide OERs that involve scope and sequence, mm-hmm. and that is the missing piece that we're really ultimately so excited about.
Mm-hmm. Okay, any questions? Representative Frederick.
Yes, Madam Chair. We've had a sort of a list of potential use, potential curriculum for some time. The problem I've run into is that the teachers often don't have the time to get a chance to look at it, to go through it, to determine what's best, which ones work. I mean, I could probably, in a quick search, find 20 different algebra programs or 20 different algebra textbooks online that would be available, but no indication of the quality of those. And I've seen some biology texts mm-hmm. and things online that were embarrassing because they were, although they were officially digital, they were actually from the 1940s. This is a concern. Who's getting it? Are you able to do something in terms of the quality, of the evaluation of the quality?
I think the collaborative, the OER collaborative, is going to be a national push in that direction. You're seeing more and more collaboration across states because we've all identified that as a critical issue. Just grabbing something off the web doesn't mean it's valuable. And as you said, there's a difference between what I consider interactive, engaging open education resources versus I just took this document and scanned it in and now I'm calling it digital. There's a big difference there. And the big difference is also in when it comes to the technology for learning, in how the teachers have had the instructional, the professional development in the pedagogy that it takes to understand the content deeply as well as the effective use of the technology together.
Let me take one follow up a little bit. Well, the other issue is not just the quality as it's presented, but how effective it is with the individual students, mm-hmm. and the ability to say, okay, this is actually working with third graders of this particular reading level, of these particular experiences. This is the concern that I've had. There are school districts that have struggled with this. I know Eugene, and I know Portland struggled with it. Beaverton as well, as I recall. So it's inserting this information into the right at the right time for teachers, and the accessibility is the question and the concern that I have.
Representative Frederick, I think we've had the same issue with textbooks. Mm-hmm. It's
Absolutely.
Now just moved into a new dimension, and something that the collaborative and the yep. work that's happening nationally will address more specifically than we've ever been able to with textbooks that have been provided by vendors where we may or may not have the option, particularly in a state like Oregon where we're not the big California or Florida that really has driven the textbook development over the last umpteen years.
And one last thing for you. Mm-hmm. This is what the Oregon Virtual School,
yes.
That was the vision that I saw for it. Am I correct that this is a continuation of that or an expansion of it? Perhaps?
When I talked about the resources that we do have available right now, the simulations, the content, some resources that will help students improve their mathematics before they go to college so that they aren't taking the remedial courses. Those sorts of things are being provided by the Oregon Virtual School District. And we're working to improve and expand the access that we have to districts, particularly some of our rural districts, and addressing credit recovery in a way that is not just, here, kid, here's your disc, have at it, but that it's a quality credit recovery process for a student that where we're seeing gains of in 80 to 90% of our students successfully completing those courses versus the 20 and 30% we're seeing now.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Barreto.
Yeah, I think capitalizing a little bit on Representative Frederick's comment, if the school district or the collaborative purchases a textbook and they find out after a year that it doesn't produce what they're thinking it would, they see a better one or one that they think would be better, are there going to be trial periods for this, you know, or the option to try it for a year, 2 years, and if it doesn't do the, you know, if they made a bad call on it, can they go back and work out of another one?
Representative Barreto, let me clarify. Are you talking about textbooks or resources from the collaborative?
Well, I'm talking about resources from the collaborative, which are actually online textbooks.
Right, but yeah. They are online, and so they are eternally flexible, and the maintenance updates that Cable was speaking of would be certainly looking at responsiveness in classes and by students.
Yeah, I guess part of the question is when you do this, when you commit to a certain textbook online, how long is that commitment for? Is it variable? I mean, do you commit for a year, 5 years? And when you said, you know, most of the books out there today are 7 to 10 years
right.
old, you know, what is the... See, in some classes, I would think they wouldn't need to be changed very often. Maybe in science, you know, you would want to do something every couple of years.
Well, this is an annual maintenance
okay.
agreement after the first ones are put out. So it would be continuously improving. In terms of overall, you know, an overhaul or changing vendors, that's a detail. I don't think we've even crossed that bridge yet because we're being very rigorous about our initial vetting.
My understanding as well is that if we create something in Oregon, in this collaborative, that isn't specific to meet our needs in Oregon, then because of the licensing, the Creative Commons licensing, we can add, augment, take out things that are in that textbook so that it meets our needs today. We don't have to wait until tomorrow or a year from now or 7 years from now to make those changes. That's the beauty of the open education resources.
It's like amending a bill.
Many times.
It's a little easier.
Okay. Anything else? We're going to need to move along. We've got to other things that I have to deal with. Representative McClain, Representative Reardon, if you could quickly go through.
Well, first of all, I mean, nobody can deny that if we're doing away with, you know, having a number of textbooks and a number of pages, we're being green. And if we're saving money, then that's helpful too. Mm-hmm. But the main issue is that the educational material is going to fit the need of the student and the teacher in individual classrooms. There's cookie cutter stuff, you know, doesn't work. And the textbook, so I just want to talk about this for a second. I'm going to go fast, Madam Chair. That we had local committees, we have local boards, and we have local teachers, and they got to get together and decide with teachers at different levels in the spectrum what they needed to match. And even though I know we've got standard core goals, we still do a little bit of work down there at the local level.
Absolutely.
And so it's a situation where, again, if it's a product, I want to know how much money the education, Department of Education, or the consortium that you're talking about is spending yearly to provide things that, again, will have to be adapted not just up here but also in every single classroom is ever used in. So how much money are we spending? Like a 1.3 for the grants last year, or how much money
right
are we
now
spending?
They're looking for foundation support.
Yeah,
so the school districts, and there wouldn't be any spending.
So
from
it would only
state.
Be from private
for these
donations.
OERs. That's the whole concept behind OERs, is that they're free and just they're not mandated.
Donations.
So if you have something better in your district that you've been working on for the past 4 years and it's doing wonderful things, then you can also mix those two. You can look at what they have and say, well, maybe we'll add this, but keep
so
mostly what we've been
doing locally.
So this
is Nike or Intel?
Already.
Nike or Intel is actually buying something like this, or who's buying it? I don't understand who's buying it.
The foundations that are supporting it. Now, Cable had a slide that Gates lists all of the
maybe it's in here.
Funders.
No, it's not in there.
It's not in there.
It's national. I believe it's Hewlett-Packard has been some of the money, possibly, and some of the not necessarily local companies. But what you're talking about in terms of that funding is specifically only to the OER Collaborative.
Right.
We also have the $1.6 million for ORVSD that we're using to provide access to content and access to courses for students across the state.
Okay. Right. Representative Reardon?
Well, I just would like, I think just quickly, if you would reiterate or confirm the belief that this material is, it's high quality, it's vetted, it's peer-reviewed, it's developed to the highest standards, just like any other textbook would be. And also that you would hope that people at the local district would go through a selection process just like they would for any other textbook. But you have the added plus, less expensive, and individual teachers can customize it. Is all of that
very easy.
True?
I think that what you're going to, because this is so new, you're going to see a higher level of vetting than has happened in most textbooks historically. Mm-hmm. And I would say that it's a cost savings in one place, but it's a shift in another. There's going to need to be professional development for teachers and how to really do quality editing of content if it's becoming a textbook that's going to be used across the district.
Is money going to teachers to write mm-hmm. and develop versus...
Correct.
Publishers.
It's a shift.
Mm-hmm. It's a good move on my part.
Okay, quickly.
Real quick.
We need to move
so
along.
So is the goal to have just one textbook throughout the entire state?
No.
So there'll be, but you're vetting vendors, you said, so there'll be a selection or a, is it limited somehow?
It's for everyone. It's not just for Oregon.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's really a pilot
but what
for this process. OER Collaborative is really a pilot process.
Excellent.
And we're moving slowly so that we're doing it right from the get-go. We'll learn a lot of lessons from the pilot and from the vetting process, and it will grow and improve over time.
Excellent. Perfect. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that's all that we had on the open textbooks. So I'm going to close the informational hearing on the open textbooks and open up an informational hearing on the Microsoft IT Academy. So we had Taylor Cowell, and I have Adrienne Wilson.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Welcome. This is technology day in house ed. We're not real technology savvy here. At least I'm not. Hey, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Doherty and House Education Committee members, for your time and persuasion this afternoon. My name is Adrian Wilson, and I'm the Director of Strategic Alliances at Microsoft. It is my job to work with education leaders, chiefs and deputies, governors and mayors, lawmakers and policy makers to build effective programs that leverage technology and improve educational outcomes. I began my career at Microsoft in 1996. As we all know, I'm going to move the slide a little bit here. I apologize. I also want Taylor to introduce herself before I carry on.
Hi, I'm Taylor Kao. I'm the Microsoft Account Executive for the K-12 accounts in Oregon.
Thank you.
Thank you, Taylor. As we all know, the landscape of employability today has shifted greatly in the past few years. The type of worker and the skills most valued in the marketplace have migrated towards careers in science, technology, engineering, math, and sometimes we also find in non-science STEM jobs there is a high demand in the ability to process information. We're in the era where knowledge workers are needed in our economy. Just want to point to this slide. If we look at the unemployment rates in Oregon today and the group between 16 and 24, the statistics say it's as high as 17.8%. And if we look at the national unemployment, it's 7.5%. And actually, the last number that came out recently from the Bureau of Labor and Statistics was 5.6%, 5.4%. In Oregon, the unemployment rate is 8.7%. So what we're seeing is that there is persistent high unemployment rates, but at the same time, there are 4,000 open jobs that indicate and require some kind of Microsoft skill today. And half of those jobs are paying more than $60,000. So what we found is more than 50% of jobs today require some level of technology skill, and the number is expected to increase to at least 77% in the next decade. At this time, like I said earlier, there are 4,000 open advertised jobs that require Microsoft skills or Microsoft certifications, representing positions across most all industries to be filled by Microsoft partners, customers, suppliers, vendors. These jobs require basic to advanced skills in technology, and employers are willing to compensate well for these skills. Again, just to iterate, half of these jobs pay greater than $60,000. I want to go to the next slide, and this zeroes in Oregon itself. And if we look here, you can see as of this month, 4,200 jobs are open. And just in Portland alone, there are about 1,900 jobs. Economists have estimated that the number of STEM jobs in Oregon will expand to 102,000 by the year 2018. a 13% increase across. And this data came up from Georgetown University Center of Education and the Workforce 2011. So the question is, how do we most effectively build programs, curriculum, and training to help Oregon students and adults to be better prepared for college and careers? How do we provide opportunities for students to pursue diplomas along the industry-recognized technical certifications? How do we help bring real-world business and technical applications into classrooms while inspiring learners to gain future employability skills? Now, this slide kind of highlights some of the Microsoft products, but I really want to highlight it's beyond the Microsoft products. What the employees are asking for, if you look at number one, is oral and communication skills. The product is a tool. Excel is an example. Employees are looking for analytical skills, but Excel is only a tool. In the certifications we're offering and the training that we're offering in curriculum, students go through a project-based learning process with the curriculum. So it's not learning how the tool works, but it's learning how to use the tool for analytical and critical thinking skills. To help address these trends and challenges and to better prepare Oregon students and adults for today's workplace, we would like to partner with the state and consider leveraging the Microsoft IT Academy and certification program statewide. It is a college and career-ready education program. It's designed to provide students with 21st century skills. And there are more than 250 courses and numerous certifications for students today. It's a package in itself. Once it's implemented, you can immediately see certifications, students being certified within the state within a few months. The Microsoft Office Specialist, for example. Before I talk about Microsoft Office Specialist, today there are 17 states that have implemented a statewide program for Microsoft IT Academy. The Microsoft Office Specialist, for example, is a certification program for Word, Excel, Outlook, a number of key products that you use and your staff use today. We're the largest, most popular IT certification program in the world today. When students earn the credential, it helps them prepare for a competitive post-secondary and workforce environment. The IT Academy and Certification Solution also includes computer science curriculum. So it's just not the tools that you're familiar with. It goes to a higher level so that students can even acquire IT skills that often get them jobs straight out of high school. There was a legislator in Alaska. Her son got certified with the IT Academy, and he's 21 years old now, and he has a job which pays $100,000. IT Academy provides a very flexible curriculum. It can integrate into the classroom. We know from experience in several states, and I'll get to the Ontario High School in a bit. We know from experience in several states across the U.S., the program benefits all students regardless of circumstances because it's a statewide program. And often we find that the rural schools benefit the most.
And this is Ontario, Oregon?
This is Ontario, Oregon. As an example, in North Carolina, they launched IT Academy program 3.5 years ago. There were 16 high school students across the entire state that earned the certification in year one. The state made a commitment to this program, and this year it reached a milestone of certifying over 100,000 students within a 3.5 year time frame. Those student achievements are coming from small and large schools, from rural and urban. Microsoft will be the first to admit that the statewide implementation of its IT Academy program will not completely satisfy Oregon's needs for career-ready graduates, but it's a solution that has proven successful in other states, and it's a step in the right direction. We stand ready to use any of our available resources to collaborate with you or any programs to seek to better prepare young adults for the modern-day workforce. Just want to point to the results that we found in North Carolina. And if you see that in a very short period of time, the ramp up, and now that we've got about 5 years of experience behind us, we're able to ramp a statewide program up quite quickly and demonstrate certifications within a 4 to 6 month time frame. Chair Doherty and House Education Committee members, thank you again for your time and consideration of this program. We'd be delighted to form an alliance with you if it'll benefit teachers, students, schools, and communities in Oregon. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Want to present, and then we'll ask questions.
Oh, no. I'm here to help answer questions.
Okay. And so I just have one question. So basically what this is a curriculum that is written and set up by Microsoft, and that, what is it, a 6, 8, 9 week, like a quarter class, a semester class?
That's correct. Usually, let's say we're looking at a particular certification. A student is going to get certified in Excel.
Mm-hmm. How
to use Excel to analyze information. That would typically be a 6 to 9 week class.
Okay.
At the end of that, the class will go and sit in a proctored assessment. They take a proctored assessment and get certified. So now they can present that to a future employer.
Right. So I have that piece of paper that I'm certified by Microsoft.
That's exactly
for Excel.
Right.
Okay.
Or going onto our website to enter in their name and find out they're certified. So it's mm-hmm. published on our website, too.
Questions, please, of the panel. Representative Redd.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are most of these 4,000 jobs that you talked about, are those right out of high school? If they have your training and they're proficient at it, then they're available right out of high school?
Chair Doherty, Representative Redd. So when we get that number, we do a search on a site called Indeed.com, and we search for Microsoft and Microsoft Office. And we've seen that it spans the gamut. It could be an IT administrator. It could be for a software engineer. It could also be for a plumber who is required to know, and this was for a plumber who had to do a DoD contract, and they were required to know how to use Excel for project planning and budget estimation of their mm-hmm. project. So we did see a full gamut of careers that required that kind of a certification.
Mm-hmm. Okay, other questions? I do have a couple of questions on, because I know I did find out, because we had a presentation earlier about coding, but it was coding as a language requirement, a world language requirement to get into colleges. But I understand that there are the coding classes maybe part of the Microsoft?
Yes. All of the Microsoft product lines are part of this IT Academy program. This program is developed for companies like New Horizon Training Companies, and it's the same material that we're providing to all the high schools mm-hmm. and all the institutions. So it's the same, providing same content as any company would be charging actually just everyday citizen to obtain the information. So it covers every single Microsoft product.
Okay, so literally all of this could be part of the STEM, the STEAM classes that they have in the high schools and middle schools. And middle schools.
That's
Representative
correct.
Reardon.
Maybe you said this. Do you have a list of which schools are participating in the academy or taking advantage of the academy?
In
Oregon?
Yeah.
We could send you the list. We do have a list that we did provide.
You could send it to Richard. We appreciate it. Okay, thank you. Because, in fact, actually, with the coding classes, I did ask a teacher that's actually out at Sunset High School, and he said in Oregon, very few high schools offer advanced college-level coding, and this was just strictly with coding. But about 44 others offer programming, and about 158 more offer computing classes.
That's right.
But he says 128 offer nothing. So this could be something that that might be useful
And
for the 128 that have nothing.
And once they've taken the classes, they can also certify themselves, so they can work towards an endpoint.
Okay.
And that would be a credential they can use in the workplace.
Yeah, so all of the training and so on and so forth would be for the teacher and all that kind of
thing. That's correct.
Okay, thank you. Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So is this a program that you offer free of charge to schools? Do you charge, is it something just to promote the Microsoft product?
Thank you for the question. Taylor, do you want to answer the question?
Yes. So this is a program that we do charge for, but we do heavily discount it for education. So this program, if you're looking at being your own company to be a training company, it would cost you $44,000 a year for your site to access all the courses, all the materials. Our pricing to the schools under academic customers is less than $1,500 per year for the exact same content and materials and courses. Mm-hmm. So we provide a heavy discount. That's a partnership that we provide mm-hmm. to be able to provide this service. And as if you're participating in a state, we will have a deployment manager to help you deploy this across the state. In the state of Washington, we worked with all the ESDs to train all the teachers and train the staff, and then individually we'll go out to different schools to train too. But that is included in the package price if you work with us as a state.
Okay, because that's not uncommon to have to go out and buy curriculums. So. Anyway, any other questions? Okay, thank you very much for your presentation, and I assume you came down from the Seattle area to help us out, because I've talked to some of the schools in Washington State, mm-hmm. and they are programs that really keep a lot of kids in school and very engaged, and some kids that never thought that they would be able to get out of high school and make a lot of money, and they do very well. So I appreciate you coming down with the information.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Okay, anyone else want to speak on the IT Academy? Microsoft Academy. Okay, with that, I close the informational hearing on the Microsoft IT Academy and open up a work session on Senate Bill 83A. Richard, could you explain which one that is?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 83A establishes supervised clinical practice experience requirements for applicants for an initial teaching license. First applies to the 2021 school year. It directs the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission to convene a work group to assist with the implementation of requirements and declares an emergency effective on passage.
Thank you. Representative Frederick.
Chair Doherty, I move Senate Bill 83A to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Frederick moves Senate Bill 83A to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none. Tia, could you read the roll, please?
Representative Pack.
Excused.
Representative McClain.
Aye.
Representative Peluso.
Aye.
Representative Reardon.
Aye.
Representative Wilson.
Aye.
Say aye.
Representative Barreto.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frederick.
Yes.
Vice Chair Springer.
Aye.
Chair Doherty.
Aye. Okay, with that, the motion passes. Representative Peluso, would you like to carry that bill?
Certainly.
Thank you very much. Okay, with that, I close the work session on Senate Bill 83A and open up a work session on 135, Senate Bill 135A.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 135A directs the Department of Education to pay for costs of education of students in eligible day treatment programs and eligible residential treatment programs by making grants and aid to school districts where programs are located, specifies the exclusions to the cost of education, and declares an emergency effective July 1, 2015.
Carl. Chair Doherty, I move Senate Bill 135A to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Frederick moves Senate Bill 135A to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none. Clerk, read the roll, please.
Representative McClain.
Aye.
Representative Peluso.
Aye.
Representative Reardon.
Aye.
Representative Wilson.
Aye.
Representative Barreto.
Aye.
Representative Packard.
Excused.
Vice Chair Frederick.
Yes.
Vice Chair Springer?
Aye.
Chair Doherty?
Aye. Okay, with that, Senate Bill 135A moves to the floor. Is there a somebody like to carry it? Mr. Wilson, would you like to do this?
Or? Why, certainly.
Okay, how about Representative Wilson? Okay, so did I close it?
Not yet.
Okay, close the work session on Senate Bill 135A and open up a work session on... We're done.
Nope.
Oh, excuse me. Senate Bill 667A.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 667A extends the sunset related to grants distributed to small school districts with one or more small high schools. It declares an emergency effective on passage.
What? Representative Frederick.
Chair Doherty, I move Senate Bill 667A to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Frederick moves Senate Bill 667A to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Well, I don't know about this bill. Oh, he's not listening. Okay, seeing no discussion, Tia, could you read the roll, please?
Representative Wilson.
Aye.
Representative Reardon.
Aye.
Representative Wilson.
Aye.
Representative Bretto.
Aye.
Representative Hack.
Excused.
Representative McLean.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frederick.
Yes.
Vice Chair Springer.
Aye.
Chair Doherty.
Aye. Okay, with that, Senate Bill motion passes. I'll carry this one to the floor. How's that?
Would Representative Huffman want to carry it, maybe?
Or maybe, how about Representative Huffman? Oh, we will give it to Representative Huffman. Okay, with that, I close the work session on Senate Bill 667A.
Would you give it to whoever's absent? Would you ever give the bill to whoever's absent?
It's too late.
Never mind.
Too late.
It's too late, what? Huh? Yeah. Too late. Yes, Representative Springer.
If it's okay with Representative Wilson, could I carry Senate Bill 135A?
Yes. Is that all right with Representative Wilson?
Whatever.
Yes.
So 135A. Okay. I'm opening up a work session on Senate Bill 135A. It will be carried by Representative Springer. I close the work session on Senate Bill 135A.
Are you wanting me to do something for what? Who?
For him.
Who?
Wilson. No.
Oh, for Carl. I didn't know he was
Carl,
out. Okay. Chair Doherty, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of allowing Representative Wilson to vote on Senate Bill 79A. It will not change the outcome of the vote.
Okay. Representative Springer moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of allowing Representative Wilson to vote on Senate Bill 79A. It will not change the outcome of the vote. The motion is not debatable. So those of the opinion that the rules will be suspended for the purpose of allowing Representative Wilson to vote on Senate Bill 79A will say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? No. Okay, motion carries. The rules have been suspended. Representative Wilson, how do you vote?
I will vote aye.
Okay, Representative Wilson votes aye. And with that, I do believe that is the end of our business.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I just want to remind you that there is no meeting on Friday. There is a meeting Monday and Wednesday of next week.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Meeting adjourned.
There you go.
Thank you very much. Meeting adjourned.
There you go.
Cool.